Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so listen, the shutdown is over, the debt limit has been moved, but you know we're doing this all over again in a couple of months, right? That much, people, is for certain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 17th of October. It's a Thursday. Great, as always, to have you with us. And this is what we know as of this moment. The government is going to stay open until the 15th of January. The Treasury Department can borrow money until the 7th of February. What happens after that is anybody's guess. And that, the whole anybody's guess thing, is the problem. Uncertainty is another word for what consumers and businesses are facing right now. They hate uncertainty, as we've told you, and that makes for an unhappy economy. Sally Herships gets us going today.
Government workers are back, and so are their paychecks, including salary for time missed. But what about contractors? No work, no pay. And some of them now have trust issues with the government.
I was hoping that when we came out of the furlough and shutdowns, we would kind of be like able to breathe a sigh of relief.
Dana Marlowe works with Accessibility Partners, contracted by the government to make technology accessible for people with disabilities.
And now with this brand new January deadline, it feels like, uh-oh, we could be going through this again.
Marlowe says this shutdown cost her company tens of thousands of dollars. Given that in just a few months there could be another shutdown, what's a contractor to do?
The first thing that we see them doing is hoarding cash.
Eric Crucius is a partner at Center Law Group in Virginia. He says smart contractors are making sure they have the means to pay overhead costs, which continue whether there's a shutdown or not. And there is another more drastic step. Consider not working for the government at all. Theo Watson is an attorney with Watson & Associates in Colorado. He says companies should consider finding more work in the private sector.
A lot of contractors just solely wait on payment from the government. That's their bread and butter. However, when that shuts down, the whole business is crippled.
It's not just contractors and government employees who suffer. Eric Crucius says uncertainty has a corrosive effect on the entire economy.
Certainly, there has been a tremendous cost to the wider economy. I have seen it with our clients alone.
Standard & Poor's estimates this shutdown cost $24 billion. Today, Bloomberg said its Consumer Comfort Index plummeted to its lowest level since late March. It found nearly half of Americans believe the economy is getting worse. Crucius says that's uncertainty taking its toll.
You're seeing a lot less people on the streets, a lot less people willing to make big purchases when they're uncertain about their future.
With consumer spending such an important part of the economy, our uncertainty could end up costing a lot more. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Most of the 500,000 or so federal workers who were furloughed got to go back to work today. Jason Alexander is a hydrologist at the U.S. Geological Survey out in Lincoln, Nebraska, back on the job after a couple of weeks gone. Mr. Alexander, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks, Guy. Good to talk to you.
What was it like walking into work today after 2.5, 3 weeks gone?
It felt great. As a scientist, I like to get back to work. I like numbers, and that's just what I want to do.
Were there reports piled up that you hadn't gotten to? I guess probably not, because nobody was there to pile them up, huh?
There's nothing to pile up while I'm gone. Work left behind.
Yeah, so how are you going to pick it up? How long is it going to take you to get back up to speed?
Probably about the same amount of time that I was off. So that's about how long it's going to take to get back up to speed. And then of course there's more on top of that. So
there always is. Are you happy? Are you frustrated? What are you?
I'm relieved. It's good to be back to work. Most of us scientists at the USGS, one of the questions that's often asked when during these shutdown preparations is, can I still work? Most scientists just want to work, crunch numbers, and be the geeks that they are, and we enjoy what we do.
Did you work?
I can't say that I worked.
Nudge, nudge, wink,
yeah,
wink.
Exactly.
That's actually pretty funny. How bad was the squeeze financially? I mean, I don't know if your wife works or any of that stuff, but how much longer could you have gone without, missing a mortgage payment or something?
We could have gone. We are in a lucky situation. We could have gone a fair amount longer because we've been pretty lucky financially. My wife has a good job. She's only been working for 8 months. We both make reasonably good money, and so we've been okay. But certainly one of the biggest stresses for me was just that my wife is due with child in 2 days.
Oh, my.
And so,
you got a lot
going
on.
It's nice to know that, and she finishes her job in 2 days then, too. And so it's nice to know that one of us will have a job when our second child comes to us.
Boy or girl, you know yet?
It's a girl.
All right. Good for you.
No names.
No names. Yeah, of course not. And even if you have one, don't tell anybody. Because they always,
exactly. Yeah. We've made that mistake.
Are you ready to do this again in whatever it's going to be, 3 months, the next time the shutdown deadline comes around?
Well, I'm just going to hope that it never happens again. It's everybody gets anxious about it. We all love what we do, and we sort of just put our heads down and nose to the grindstone and do our work. But let's just hope it doesn't happen again. I hope that's not the case.
Well, Mr. Alexander, thanks very much for your time, and good luck with the baby.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, Jason Alexander, we got him out in Lincoln, Nebraska. If you're the type who likes logic in your stock market reports, today is not the day for you. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We hear about big companies getting hacked in one way or another pretty regularly. Customer information of some kind is stolen, credit cards or account numbers or passwords. But for every one of those, there are plenty of hacks we don't hear about against small and medium-sized businesses. Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains what makes those firms vulnerable and why they are often reluctant to come forward.
It was March 2010, the height of the financial crisis, and the housing market was in the dumps. Michelle Marsico, she owns Village View Escrow, which is just south of Los Angeles. Well, she was having a slow day.
So I didn't have to log on to my bank.
She didn't have deposits coming in or any money going out, or so she thought. 2 days later, when she did log in, she saw $465,000 was missing from Valley View's bank account. Turns out she'd been hacked.
I just kind of went into shock, like, what does this mean? Then I thought, well, I'm going to call my bank. They can put the money back in. We'll get it cleared up.
Here's what the bank said.
We're not responsible for this. I'm like, are you kidding?
You might be thinking the same thing. But unlike personal checking and savings accounts, business accounts aren't protected from hackers. One malicious email or bad attachment, and boom, hackers have access to passwords and bank account numbers.
Small mom and pop shops, they do not understand that banking online comes with serious risks.
Brian Krebs is a cybersecurity expert and blogger. He says lots of small companies that do get hacked often go out of business. And lots of businesses don't want to talk about getting hacked for fear it will scare off their customers. That makes reliable numbers of this kind of cybercrime hard to come by. But in 2010, the FBI said it was investigating more than 400 of these cyberbank robberies, and about $85 million had been lost.
The problem is a lot of these financial institutions are offering online banking services, but they haven't changed the way they do security in 10 years.
Small businesses who suspect their banks are at fault and want to sue can have a tough time. Julie Bonnell Rogers is a lawyer at the Dinsell Law Group in San Jose.
I'm receiving calls from people who are in the oil industry. I've had people call me that are in the private airline industry. I've had people call me that are in the construction industry.
She represented Marsico as a favor when Marsico sued her bank, Professional Business Bank. Roger says she almost never takes these cases because they're tough to win. Even when they do, attorney's fees often aren't covered, and most small businesses can't afford to pay up front.
Who has money for a lawsuit against the Goliath that is a financial institution when you've just been hit with cyber theft? A small business can't.
In Marsico's case, it took her 2 years, but the bank eventually settled. Marsico agreed not to talk about the details of the settlement, and the bank didn't return a phone call. Marsico says she lost some business by going public.
The reason why I even share my story, which was at risk of my business, is because we got to stop this.
And to stop it, businesses have to become aware. And Marsico says banking laws must be changed to protect them. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but Facebook is changing its privacy policy again. That's a phrase that always gets a lot of attention. Today, it's teenagers. Up till now, users under 18 could only share their posts with their friends or friends of friends. Not anymore. All you listeners out there in the 13 to 17 demographic, first of all, thanks for listening. Seriously. Second, though, and more to the point, you can now make it so that your Facebook posts can be seen by everybody, including a whole bunch of companies that are dying to sell you stuff. Marketplace's David Weinberg's got that story.
Facebook has a problem. Teenagers are fleeing the site for other social media outlets. One reason for the exodus, everyone and their mom has a Facebook account. Posting something your whole family can see isn't ideal for some teens. And here lies a conundrum. Teens want this privacy on one hand, but they also want to be heard even more.
You have to realize the world of a teen is relatively small, and social media and social networking make their world a lot bigger.
Jay Baer is the author of Utility, Why Smart Marketing is About Help, Not Hype. He says the problem with Facebook's old privacy policy was that teens could only get likes and comments from friends and friends of friends.
So it's much more interesting, certainly for my children and other teens, when they get likes and comments and shares and interactions from people that they don't know.
It's those strangers interacting with teens on Facebook that worry Dr. Wendy Patrick. She's a business ethics lecturer and sex crimes prosecutor.
Everything from cyber bullies to cyber stalkers to cyber predators can now view personal information of teenagers.
Patrick worries that the privacy changes could make teenagers more vulnerable on the web. But Baer thinks that ultimately this is not so much an age issue as it is a personal data one.
It's not about teens. It's about reaching Julie, the 15-year-old in Des Moines, and understanding all the things that Julie cares about and sending her the perfect ad at the perfect time. What that requires is data.
The privacy changes could produce a flood of data for marketers looking to get a share of teen spending, which, according to True Research, is worth more than $800 billion worldwide. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
This is an interesting time in the business of news. While newspaper circulations continue to decline, billionaires are showing more interest. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos recently bought the Washington Post. Warren Buffett has been buying up local papers right and left. And this week, word of a new media company funded by one of the billionaires behind eBay. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers the kind of journalism that can be had for $250 million.
The new media company has not been publicly named. Few details have been released. But we do know that it will be all digital, and it will be funded by an eBay founder, Pierre Omidyar, to the tune of $250 million. That's the same price Amazon's Jeff Bezos paid for the Washington Post. Jeff Jarvis directs the Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York.
What we need in journalism more than anything is more views of how to sustain it. So if we have some true entrepreneurs like Pierre Omidyar and Jeff Bezos coming in willing to invest in the future of journalism, that's a good sign. That's fresh blood, fresh ideas, I hope.
Omidyar already owns a news site in Hawaii where he experimented with different business models, even charging for access. Joshua Benton directs the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard.
He is thinking about media and in a civically minded way, but also in a way that is not tied to the general conceptions of what an online news site should look like. He's willing to try new things.
One thing the new media company does have is employees, several high-profile journalists, including Glenn Greenwald. Greenwald brings with him an as-yet unpublished trove of security documents from Edward Snowden. Benton says the new media company could fill a gap in American reporting.
If there's one thing that we've really lost as newspapers have lost resources, it's the quantity of watchdog accountability reporting.
Watchdog reporting has never been a real moneymaker. Perhaps that's why the new media company is planned to be a comprehensive site, not just investigative journalism, but sports, too. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, high stakes in Hollywood.
We know that it tends to be safer to make these big bets, but they still fail. And when they fail, they fail spectacularly.
Yes, they do. But first, let's us do the numbers. All right, so the Dow Industrial shaved 2 points, a hundredth of 1%, closed at 15,371. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ added 23.6%, finished at 3863. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, also 0.6%, closed at 1733. IBM weighed on the Dow today, dropped more than 6% after revenue fell short of analyst estimates. Goldman Sachs also reported disappointing revenue, lost 2.4%, Goldman did. Stanley Black & Decker fell an additional 3% today. Its shares are down 17% this week since the toolmaker lowered its forecast, blaming, and wait for this one, economic uncertainty. We're not making any of this up, caused by the federal shutdown. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.59%. Quite a drop. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. Earnings season continues with GE releasing quarterly results. New York and Chicago were connected via a long-distance telephone line on October 18, 1892. Only one call could be placed at a time. Kind of a different meaning for call waiting, huh? And are you tired of your beard? Tomorrow is No Beard Day. So shave it. Come on, it'll grow back. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our guy out in Lincoln, Nebraska that we talked to earlier at the Geological Survey is one of several hundreds of thousands of government employees going back to work today. Also among them, statisticians, analysts, information specialists of all stripes. When all is said and done, we may learn that one of the biggest casualties of the last 3 weeks in the life of the American economy was data. Marketplace's David Gura has that slice of the shutdown.
The government collects reams of data, terabytes of data, on unemployment, on productivity. Catherine Abraham was head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics during the last government shutdown, and she says that without this data,
You just don't have a way to monitor what's going on in the economy.
Now, we'll get data collected before the shutdown started, eventually. But what about the Consumer Price Index? That measures the changing price of goods and services. Martha Farnsworth Ritchie was director of the Census Bureau during the 95 and 96 shutdowns.
You know, you can't make up data that you didn't collect.
Agencies have to decide whether to scrap reports altogether or release incomplete information. This isn't just a nuisance to researchers.
Literally hundreds of billions of dollars of federal spending is guided by this data.
Keith Hall led the Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2008 to 2012.
Companies rely on this data on everything from adjusting contracts to helping set wages to looking at what's happening in particular industries.
When the government is up and running, it collects data on education, on agriculture markets and crop prices. Jim Dunn teaches agricultural economics at Penn State.
Farmers check the data very carefully because they have to make plans about what they're going to plant.
Their buyers also rely on this information, and so do banks that lend farmers money. Government data is essential, Dunn says, to the entire food industry. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There was data news late this afternoon that will make economists and business journalists alike rejoice. The Department of Labor said it's going to come out with a September jobs report, the one that was skipped because of the shutdown, next Tuesday. That's the 22nd. Mark your calendars. The October jobs report, which should have been on the 1st of November, is going to be a week late. Friday the 8th is when we're going to get that one. High on the list of those watching the trials and tribulations of the full faith and credit of the American economy these past days has been our biggest overseas creditor, the Chinese government. Earlier this week, the state-run Xinhua News Agency had apparently had enough, saying it's time for a world that is de-Americanized. Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, went out and asked around to find out what regular Chinese think.
Most Chinese didn't read the inflammatory editorial calling for an end to Pax Americana. That's because it was only written in English, meant for a foreign audience. And boy, did that foreign audience eat it up. It appeared in the New York Times, LA Times, USA Today, among other news outlets. But are everyday Chinese people really wishing for the downfall of America because of our fiscal crisis? On a street in Shanghai, Wu Feng is more matter of fact.
Of course, it's bad news, but there are few options left to develop our economy. Buying U.S. Treasury bills is still the best way to invest our money.
Further down the street at Fudan University, Shen Dingli teaches international relations. He recites a line that could be ripped from a book of Confucius quotations to describe China's predicament.
When China opens the door, you welcome money, you welcome mosquito.
In other words, you take the good with the bad. And Professor Shen says China's reaction to the U.S. debt crisis has narrowly focused on the bad.
China has not given credit to the U.S. for China's modernization. Instead, China only be picky in criticizing the U.S. That's very unfair.
So you think that China is being a little unfair to the United States?
No, not a little unfair, greatly unfair.
I stand corrected. Shen says he's going to submit an editorial to the People's Daily, China's Communist Party mouthpiece, to rebuff the Xinhua article that slammed the U.S. He's had many editorials published before, but he's not sure if this one will get past the censors. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Sometimes our big-time entertainment seems like a pretty tired formula. Hollywood loves its superheroes. Pop songs all sound alike. That's partly because executives in the business, as it's called, kind of do have a formula for how to make stars and hits and money. Anita Alberci tells the story in her new book. It's called Blockbusters, Hit-Making, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Here's the thing I don't understand about, just to get right to it, here's the thing I don't understand about risk-taking in the world of entertainment, and I'm going to go to Hollywood first. How come they always choose the safe option, the sequel after blockbuster sequel after blockbuster sequel, and then they just make pots of money? Why do they do that?
Well, I think they do it because movie making is inherently risky. And what they're trying to do is build lasting businesses. And what Hollywood has learned, as I describe in the book, is that the idea that smaller bets are safer is a myth. And what I find is that you really have to swing for the fences if you want to have sustained success in these businesses.
All right. So let me throw out an example of swinging for the fences, failing miserably, and that would be Disney and John Carter.
Yes, that was one, and I think Lone Ranger was a more recent failure. In this summer, actually.
And think about that. It had Johnny Depp and everything.
Right. On paper, it seemed like a pretty safe investment. But to me, what's so fascinating about this movie industry that we know that it tends to be safer to make these big bets, but they still fail. And when they fail, they fail spectacularly.
What Hollywood does then is try to lay off some of that risk, and they securitize it out, and they get Wall Street involved, and they get other producing partners involved. It's not like the big studios are eager for risk.
Right. That certainly is one strategy in which they've tried to cope with risk. I think another strategy is going for these established franchises. And in fact, for the safest bets that you can think of, the Harry Potters of this world, the last thing the studios want is to have these investment partners, because the last thing they want is share what are inevitably right. going to be huge profits.
Can you explain – obviously, you've done the math on this, and I should understand it intuitively off the top of my head. But explain to me why it's safer to make a single $200 million movie than 10, $20 million movies.
Yeah. So there are a number of reasons, I think. A key reason, obviously, is that this fits the way in which consumers are making choices. You have to understand that the average moviegoer in this country sees 6 films in a year. That's
wow.
one every 2 months.
Wow.
Now, what the studios are trying to do is make sure that it's their movie.
That's fascinating, actually. Only one every 2 months. I'd have thought it would have been more than that.
Yeah, I mean, we all know the diehard moviegoers that go once a week, but those are the exception.
Huh. When you talk entertainment, obviously, in this society, it's more than just movies. It's LeBron James and sports. It's Lady Gaga and music. It's, you know, take your pick. Does the same sort of rule of thumb apply? You got to swing for the fences. You got to go big. LeBron has to build his brand, and Lady Gaga has to build her brand and do what they can.
That, for me, is one of the most fascinating aspects of this space, where we see that it pays to invest in stars. It tends to reduce the risk. But at the same time, these stars realize their power, and companies can barely afford to compete for these stars, but they also cannot afford not to compete for them.
Is the entertainment industry, movies specifically, but also the broader entertainment industry, are they as befuddled by digital technology and the web and pushing out content on different platforms as, say, the news and journalism industry is?
That's an interesting question. I think what we find is that, if anything, the impact of digital technology is creating bigger brands and bigger superstars. And so what Hollywood is discovering, and I think what the record labels are discovering, is that the future is relatively bright, and that the models that they've lived by for a while are still working nowadays.
Anita Elbersi is a professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Her book about the big business of entertainment is called Blockbuster. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which we found in the pages of the New York Times. We have done stories every now and then about fantasy sports. You pick players and you win or lose your league by how they do on the field. This, however, goes a step further. A company called Fantex Holdings is going to set up a stock market for professional athletes. Not as in athletes do the trading, but as in athletes are the stocks. Arian Foster of the NFL's Houston Texans will be the first. He is going to go public in a way. That is, Fantex is going to help him sell off $10 million worth of shares in his future earnings. Buyers, fans, I suppose, will be able to trade those shares on the exchange that Fantex will set up. And I get free markets and all, but still, it's a little creepy. I don't know. Maybe not. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this, Thursday it is. Today, the Dow give up 2 points. We'll call that unchanged. The NASDAQ gained 23.6%. The S&P 500 added 11.6% there as well. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.